prisoners of the Republic, Alan Kabuli. End of the notorious tax bill's passage, leaders of the Republicans did everything but to fall to their faces in supine servility to President Trump. They praised him with words of wonder, almost thanking him for the very air they breathed. For Americans, for men, for free people, the sight was as shocking as it was weird. Early Americans fought a bloody revolution to end the practice of free men bowing to kings. At the time, most of Europe believed that kings were ordained by God. A radical nation, the United States, threw that idea into the trash heap of history. Look today at these men who claim fealty to the so-called founding fathers. Fathers, maybe, but these are not their sons. They are Tories, servants of wealth, servants of capital, not fellow citizens. At the United Nations, the U.S. threatens the world to cut off foreign aid unless they bow to the empire. The world answered, 128 countries against, 9 in favor. The U.S. loses by a landslide. Politics of bullies reigns, both here and abroad. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Yeah, bullies. Indeed, I think he's got it. Reminds me that I've heard it in a couple of places that they're talking about, oh, well, this is News from Neptune. This is Paul Muth speaking at you. Hang around for a while. I think I have some interesting stuff, some Chris Hedges. But apparently the discourse in the White House about Korea is the idea of bloodying their nose with a quick strike that they think won't be answered back because of the overwhelming force that the U.S. could offer. I don't know. It's pretty revolting. Amy Goodman's got a piece about well, it impinges on a lot of things. I'm going to go to it right away. That's a regular feature here. I mentioned Chris Hedges being interviewed on Law and Disorder. I can't get it all on. He talks about his Christian faith a little bit, a revolutionary spirit, the Jesus figure as a person on death row because of opposition to the elite. Telling that doesn't always get heard. So, well, let's listen to Amy Goodman break the sound barrier. Some success on this front, actually. Mexican journalist has gotten a reprieve from, looks like almost certain death if he goes back at the hands of the state or the hands of some of the gangs. They're kind of interchangeable, according to him.
Emilio Gutierrez Soto and the fight to protect journalists. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. For the 25th year in a row, the Committee to Protect Journalists has released its annual survey of journalists killed around the world. The list includes 42 journalists and 4 media workers killed, some while covering war, others murdered in retaliation for their reporting. Another 20 were killed in circumstances that CPJ cannot confirm were related to their work. A record 262 journalists were imprisoned around the world, with Turkey, China, and Egypt topping the list for the second year in a row. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump wages a relentless campaign to discredit journalism in the U.S., often with rhetoric that could potentially incite his followers to violence. Trump's policy of ramping up mass deportations could even send one Mexican journalist currently jailed in the U.S. back to Mexico, where he might be killed. Emilio Gutierrez Soto is being held in immigration detention in El Paso, Texas, along with his 24-year-old son, Oscar. They fled Mexico in 2008, seeking political asylum after Emilio received death threats for his work as a reporter.
I wrote some articles where I described how the military acting in the northwest of Chihuahua.
That's Emilio speaking to us via telephone on the Democracy Now! NewsHour from the Immigration and Customs Enforcement prison.
This caused disgust at the Ministry of Defense, which sent the head of the 5th Military Zone in Chihuahua, General Garcia Vega, to threaten me, saying I'd already written 3 articles noting corruption and assaults against the population by members of the military. And he sentenced me. He said, you've written 3 articles, and there's not going to be a 4th one. And, of course, there was a 4th article.
That was in 2005. In 2008, Emilio received an urgent message from a friend who'd heard from someone in the military that he was being targeted for assassination. He grabbed his vital documents and his son Oscar and fled to the U.S. After 7 months in detention, he was released pending a court ruling on his request for political asylum. Emilio and Oscar survived by operating a food truck in New Mexico until last July, when the judge ruled against him. They were taken to the immigration jail in handcuffs. From detention, Emilio appealed the decision.
If we are deported, that obviously implies death. If the government didn't give its consent for criminal groups to work with impunity, certainly the conditions would be different. But the government of Mexico facilitates the work of criminal groups who operate with total impunity. The government of Mexico, we all know, is the most corrupt government in the hemisphere and obviously enjoys no credibility.
Again, Emilio Gutierrez Soto speaking to Democracy Now! In a jailhouse interview. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports Mexico is the country with the highest number of journalists killed explicitly in retaliation for their reporting. Just last week, journalist Gumaro Pérez Aguinaldo was murdered in the southern state of Veracruz, gunned down while attending a Christmas pageant at his son's school. He was at least the 12th journalist to be killed in Mexico so far this year. On the Friday before Christmas, Bill McCarran, the executive director of the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and Texas Democratic Congress member Beto O'Rourke met with Emilio and Oscar at the El Paso ICE Detention Center, and then met with William Joyce, acting field office director for ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement in El Paso, and ICE's local chief counsel, Elias Castello, to request Emilio and Oscar's release. In addition to the compelling proof that journalists are regularly killed in Mexico, McCarran brought a petition with 18,000 signatures from across the United States demanding Emilio and Oscar's release. According to McCarran, Chief Counsel Castello told them to tone it down. McCarran took that to mean they should be less public in their campaign to support Emilio. The head of the National Press Club said, "We're here to shed light when we believe someone is being arbitrarily detained. It's our job to ensure everyone knows his name." Well, on Wednesday, the U.S. Board of Immigration Appeals granted Emilio and Oscar a full stay of their deportation order. The case will be moved from the Texas border region to Virginia, where his advocates hope Emilio's dire situation will receive proper consideration. In addition, his legal team wants them released immediately pending appeal. Even in the United States, where a free press is enshrined in the Constitution, the climate for reporting has gotten so bad that a coalition of organizations led by the Freedom of the Press Foundation has organized the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker to, quote, provide reliable, easy-to-access information on the number of press freedom violations in the United States, from journalists facing charges to reporters stopped at the U.S. border or asked to hand over their electronics, unquote. Journalism is an unacceptably dangerous profession the world over. Democracy depends on a vigorous free press, and it's up to all of us to demand it and to defend it. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, kind of set up. As I say, I've got Moore Hedges. The interview's about 40 minutes long. It's premised on the idea that he collaborated on a book called The Unspeakable, or Unspeakable, Things That Aren't Outside the Limits of Allowable Debate. That's a Chomskyan phrase. It's pretty wide-ranging, but first I'm going to replay an interview with Bruce Cummings, who is apparently unapproachable by the mainstream and corporate media and public media. He used to be on the NewsHour from PBS now and again. I guess he's challenging too many commonplaces about South Asia, Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia, I guess you call it, don't you? Korea, etc., and China. And I think he cuts through some of the absolute crap that goes down as coverage. And he was on Amy's show relatively recently. Well, not really, but by the standards of how often he gets a call, I suppose, these days. Speaking of Amy Goodman, I think she still intros her show as from Pacifica, but I think she actually, her show and enterprise is freestanding. She's just crediting Pacifica for the inception. Pacifica Foundation voted to reorganize under Chapter 11 bankruptcy. WBAI is the main root of some really major financial problems. They have a judgment of like $1.3 million or something for their tower rental, something they've been trying to get out of, but they're going to reorganize, try to find a new location and a new location on the dial. They have a, since they've been around so many years, they have a commercial band. I don't know what commercial band radio goes for in New York City, but they're hoping that it'll help stop digging, as it were. So I've been worried about this quite a bit of late, and it's hard to find good information. Doug Henwood's Facebook page is what I'm relying on now. He has a connection to the station manager out in KPFA. He's a refugee from WBAI. He had some problems with some of the people there. Gary Null, if you Google that, you'll probably find some strange stories. It's actually spelled N-U-L-L. And it's too complicated to even begin to unpack, but Doug Henwood, new show, or a new place for a show, but long-standing show, Behind the News. He has Andrew Coburn on, talking about the Saudi involvement in 9/11. How about that? And then Asad Haider talking about, like, that name rings a bell as a comedian. I don't know if that's true or not. This is a reprise of a show that already went out, so, but you may not have caught it, and now it's in a new location. Anyway, nothing going on around town except for the impending Siberian polar vortex, I guess. Maybe we should postpone New Year's Day parties. I've just heard about one so far being likely postponed. All right, Bruce Cummings talking to Michael Slate out of KPFK, Pacific Station I don't often get to. I guess Scott Horton's show I've most frequently, he's a frequent discussant on his show, is Gareth Porter, so I go to him. Gareth hasn't done any phone interviews or radio interviews in a while that I know of. But anyway, here's a reprise of Bruce Cummings' important issue on Korea and stuff that you won't hear, I don't think, anywhere else. Well, it was a double click here.
The system. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to have this guy back with us. He's Dr. Bruce Cummings. He's the Gustavus F. and Ann M. Swift Distinguished Professor in History at the University of Chicago. And he's the author of many books, including The Korean War and Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. And he's going to be talking with us about the new danger of war with North Korea and what the hell is going on right now with all this stuff that's happening. And if you don't break out in a cold sweat when you hear Trump and all these various Nazis talking, you better start thinking about why you don't, all right? Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure.
Pleased to be here.
Yeah, good, man. So, listen, anyone listening to the news today, right, they learned that North Korea has fired an intermediate-range ballistic missile. They've tested a nuclear missile. The missile that they fired passed over northern Japan, and it's all and they say that they're ratcheting up the threat of war that would likely result in tens of thousands of deaths just in a few hours. That's what's actually happening, is that is objectively being ratcheted up, I think. I mean, look at everything that's going out there now, and even more recently, where you see Secretary of Defense James Mattis recently stating that any threat to the U.S. or its territories will be met with a massive military response that is both effective and overwhelming. And then there is Trump, and need we say more? So what do you make of this, Bruce? What's going on here?
Well, there never has been an administration that has threatened an attack on North Korea so frequently and with such hyperbole. Never before Trump. Trump himself has no experience whatsoever in foreign affairs. He knows nothing about Korea. I imagine he would have had trouble finding North Korea on a map a couple of years ago. So it's just doubly and triply dangerous because he has three advisors, all military men, former generals, his chief of staff, Kelly, his national security advisor, McMaster, and Mad Dog Mattis, who Trump particularly seems to favor. And so you have a naive president surrounded by military people and hardly anyone, and I would say including Tillerson, the Secretary of State, who has any experience with diplomacy. And yet American diplomacy toward North Korea has achieved great goals in spite of what I think Trump just said yesterday, that we've talked for 25 years and have gotten nowhere. President Clinton and his Secretary of Defense, later Special Ambassador for North Korea, William Perry, not only froze all of North Korea's fissile material, at that time plutonium, for 8 years, but in 2000, they had a deal to indirectly buy out North Korea's medium and long-range missiles. A North Korean general came to meet Clinton in the White House. They signed a statement saying neither country would have hostile intent toward the other. Madeleine Albright then went to Pyongyang to meet the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il 2 weeks later. She was working out an arrangement for President Clinton to visit Pyongyang in December 2000. And if he had done that, Kim Jong-il was willing to put North Korea inside the missile technology control regime. This is something that would limit their missiles to a 300-kilometer range. South Korea is also part of the MTCR. I say this in some detail because the discourse, and now it's a bipartisan discourse, Democrats and Republicans, is that North Korea cheats all the time. It's a terrible threat, you know, blah, blah, blah. I would encourage your listeners to just go to the New York Times website and look at Michael Gordon's long article on this missile deal, March 6, 2001, or read William Perry's memoir that came out a couple of years ago. North Korea was fully within an American-sanctioned regime that would have kept its plutonium frozen and would have eliminated its missile threat. And along comes George W. Bush. Obviously, the worst thing he did was invade Iraq, which is a continuing, unfolding catastrophe. But the second worst thing he did is to kick over these agreements with North Korea. He refused to pursue the missile agreement. And then, as part of his preemptive doctrine, he targeted North Korea along with Iraq and Iran, and then sent an emissary to Pyongyang in October 2002 to accuse them of having a second nuclear program, this time with enriched uranium, whereupon the North Koreans kicked the emissary out and kicked out the inspectors from the UN that had been there 8 years, got back all their plutonium, and busted off their first atomic bomb in 2006. So Bush really is responsible for two catastrophic failures. One, with Iraq and the other with North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, because something, you know, that I've been thinking about a lot since this has all come up and since the last time we spoke, and then just reading a lot of the coverage of this, Trump actually is accusing North Korea, as you're pointing to, he's accusing North Korea of contempt for their neighbors and violating minimum standards of acceptable international behavior, that North Korea is threatening and destabilizing the region. And it does say something when you think about it, what North Korea has said, and I don't think that North Korea is any bastion or beacon of hope in the world, but actually in what's happening here is that what they're doing to them, they're actually saying that they're doing the stuff where they're saying they're unstable and they're trying to, you know, get out and destroy and take over all of Korea and they're threatening nuclear war on everyone. But actually, even the recent missile tests and the ways that they've developed things have been more in response to what people aren't paying attention or what people aren't talking about a whole lot, is there's major war games that were going on there, war games that were actually directed primarily at making a point to North Korea. Is that true?
Well, the U.S. has pursued war games going back into the Bush administration in Korea that target the leadership for decapitation attacks. They also practice landing tens of thousands of Marines behind North Korean lines in a preemptive attack to march on Pyongyang and replace the leadership. And, of course, the U.S. has blackmailed North Korea going back now really almost 70 years to 1950. With nuclear weapons. We had nuclear weapons stationed in South Korea from 1958 to 1991. And every time North Korea tests a missile or a bomb, the president, and that would include Trump or Obama or Bush, will send B-2 nuclear-capable bombers over South Korea. Obama did some dummy atomic bomb drops on South Korean islands during his presidency. So, I mean, I have to say that the history that I just went through from the 1990s is generally not known, very important to bring out. But what the media and American officials and spokespeople and all of that never examine is the history of American nuclear intimidation of North Korea. If you just assume, I mean, as you said, North Korea is no beacon of hope for the world. But if you say this is country X colored blue instead of red, and just look at the world from their standpoint, they've been under this threat now for more than 50 years. In the early 60s, Kim Il-sung openly said, we have no defense against nuclear weapons except to build underground. And so they've created some 15,000 underground subterranean facilities related to national security. Almost their entire military is underground. You know, and they are able now with their engineers to dig very deep so that even a direct nuclear hit would not take out the leadership. You may remember that was how the Iraq war started, with shock and awe, taking out a bunker where Saddam Hussein was supposed to be hiding. It turned out he wasn't there, of course. But at any rate, looking at the world from North Korea's standpoint, you almost would become paranoid and defensive and desperate for your own security. If I could say another thing about the region, North Korea's medium-range missile fired over Japan was unquestionably a provocative act. They've never fired a medium-range missile over Japan, but it went over at about 350 miles up. They also launched a rocket trying to put up a satellite in 1998, and the papers after that said the rocket was launched over Japan. I mean, it entered the stratosphere over Japan. There are two things to say about this. Number one, what other direction are they going to fire it, over China or Russia? Number two, it always is optimal to launch missiles to the east to take advantage of the Earth's rotation. This is just rocket science 101 for people who know about launching rockets, but it's never mentioned in our media that North Korea doesn't have a whole hell of a lot of directions in which to shoot these things, and it's to their advantage to shoot them to the east.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Bruce Cummings from the University of Chicago. He's a history professor at the University of Chicago, and he's the author of many books on the Korean War and Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria, and many others, actually. We're talking about what's going on with North Korea and what the U.S. is doing in relation to that. I was just thinking, when you were talking, I was thinking about something that I read in what you wrote and then some other places. You know, this whole point about all the various manifestations of U.S. military power, generally, what they aim at doing is keeping North Korea in a constant state of siege and terror. And that goes all the way back, to a certain extent, it goes all the way back to what happened after the Korean War and what happened in those decades, you know, between the Korean War and now, where basically North Korea might not have even had nukes at all if the U.S. had kept his word instead of being actually focusing on what they have done, and which is really what they intended, was to basically keep North Korea under their heel.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. very consciously violated the armistice of 1953. The armistice agreement was, it prohibited upgrading of weapons within Korea, and of course both sides immediately started upgrading their weapons after the war ended in 1953. But in top secret documentation from the Eisenhower administration, you see Secretary of State Dulles acknowledging that both sides, or all sides, including South Korea, the Chinese, North Korea, and the U.S., have been upgrading their weaponry, but introducing nuclear weapons violates the armistice. And Dulles was very much a legalist, and he, for a time, he opposed putting nuclear weapons into Korea. But then Admiral Radford, a real hawk back in the 1950s, argued that nuclear weapons were important and we could go ahead and break the armistice. Who's going to try and enforce it or do anything to us about it? And so the U.S. went ahead and violated the armistice. Now, when you look at contemporary North Korean rhetoric, they hit on two points over and over again. Their tests of bombs and nukes will end or stop when A, the U.S. is not hostile to North Korea, and B, when the U.S. stops running these war games. Now, Nikki Haley said this week that it's insulting to imagine trading off our war games for their nukes and missiles. But that's exactly what Bill Clinton did in 1994. The U.S. had been running the largest war games in the world called Team Spirit from 1976 until the early 1990s. More than 200,000 troops, Korean and American, sometimes participated in these war games. The North Koreans demanded that they stop as part of the deal to freeze their reactor in 1994, their plutonium reactor. And the U.S. agreed to that. Then the Bush administration, as part of its preemptive doctrine, started war games up again. They're not as large as Team Spirit, but my point is it's entirely within the history of American diplomacy toward North Korea to make that trade-off of halting our war games in return for them stopping their testing. This is what China and Russia have called a freeze-freeze agreement. We freeze our war games, they freeze their nukes and missiles. And both of those things hark back to the best diplomacy that the U.S. ever achieved with North Korea, which was the Perry process from 1998 to 2000, freezing the plutonium and getting rid of their missiles. So this idea that North Korea, you know, has no other choice or is just hell-bent on developing a complete nuclear arsenal goes right against the actual history of our diplomacy with North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bruce, one of the things that I kept thinking about here, too, is you make a point in a number of places, and I think it's really important for people to understand that North Korea made clear when they developed nuclear weapons that this was not based on first strike capacity. Ignoring this kind of thing has actually allowed the U.S., and actually lying about it, has allowed the U.S. to actually sort of amp up what they intend to do, or the kind of nuclear terrorism that they're practicing against North Korea, right?
Well, North Korea doesn't have either a first strike or a second strike in its strategy, because the first time that they would use a nuclear weapon, we would obliterate them. Colin Powell, more than 20 years ago in 1995, said if the North used a nuclear weapon in anger, we would turn North Korea into a charcoal briquette. Of course, what most people don't know is we already did that during the Korean War with 3 years of carpet bombing, so that hardly a modern building stood in any of North Korea's cities. And of course, that's something the North Koreans know like the back of their hand. And recall all the time, most of them would have lost parents or grandparents in that bombing, at least one or, you know, a relative. Americans don't know anything about the Korean War, let alone this destruction of North Korea. There's something just vicious, villainous about prominent Americans like Colin Powell, who I like very much, Hillary Clinton, who also referred to demolishing North Korea. It's a bipartisan principle that if North Korea, if we get into a war, no matter how it starts, and North Korea might be about to use a nuclear weapon or uses a nuclear weapon, that we would wipe the face of North Korea clean and turn it into a charcoal briquette. It's really a long history of these terrible threats. I wrote a piece in the London Review of Books last May where I pointed out that even a small, so-called small nuclear war in which maybe 10 weapons were detonated, like the example that scientists use is a quick nuclear war between Pakistan and India, that would likely produce 2 years of nuclear winter and lead to the failure of crops on a world scale and the deaths of millions or starvation of millions of people. Nuclear weapons are terrible weapons of mass destruction, far worse than biological or chemical weapons, and they should be abolished. But particularly the way Trump and his people throw around nuclear threats at North Korea, it's just nauseating.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, one of the things is, and it's pretty heavy, I think, when you think about this, is that the U.S. is actually, what you were saying about what they did during the Korean War, you know, and actually to add to what you said, it's also that they did carry out the murder of over 30% of the population during that war, 3 to 5 million people. And you look at this and you think about one big bone of contention is that they even, in all of this, they have never, ever recognized the legitimacy of North Korea as a state. And in fact, you pointed out that North Korea is the only country in the world that has been systematically blackmailed by U.S. nukes going back to the 50s, literally terrorized.
That's right. I mean, the total numbers of dead are not really known from the Korean War. North Korea only had 8 or 9 million people when the war started, and I would estimate about 2 million died. That's one in every four people, which puts North Korea on a par with Poland and Russia as the three worst casualty totals of any war in the 20th century, you know, in terms of their populations, their relative populations. North Korea was not recognized when it established itself 69 years ago on September 9th, 1948. We started embargoes against them before the Korean War in 1949, when we slapped embargoes on both Communist China and North Korea. We've embargoed them ever since. It's they themselves, their entire ideology and their nationalism has to do with being recognized, having dignity as a people and a country, not being disrespected, and on that basis, joining with the world community. And because they have never gotten either recognition by the U.S., by the way, I should tell your viewers that almost all of our allies, with the exception of Japan and South Korea, have normalized relations with North Korea years ago. I mean, Canada, Australia, France, Germany, England. We're one of the only countries in the world that doesn't recognize North Korea. But anyway, we could solve this problem with North Korea very quickly and get a freeze on any future nuclear or missile activity by, one, declaring that we are not in a hostile relationship with them, stopping the war games, number two. Number three, recognizing them diplomatically. And all of a sudden, North Korea would be more like Cuba, which we now have an embassy in and which Americans visit. And I mean, what's the worst that has happened since Obama normalized relations with Cuba? More tourists and a boost to the Cuban economy. So it's quite possible to follow those three steps and normalize relations with North Korea, but I sincerely doubt that this administration would even be willing to do one of those things.
Yeah. We have time for one more question, and it's only going to be about 2 minutes, so I'll ask you real quick.
Sure.
Sanctions. Oftentimes people think sanctions might be a lesser way to go at things, but sanctions actually would have an enormous bad impact on North Korea. It'd be collective punishment of all of the people, right?
Well, North Korea, as I said, has been sanctioned since 1949, and the sanctions have just been increased in recent years under both Obama and Trump. The U.S. succeeded in getting China to shut off coal imports from North Korea, which was a major, about $1 billion item in their trade with China. Now people are calling for China to shut off oil, and that would impose great hardship on the North Korean people themselves. But Peter Hayes, who's the best expert on North Korean energy, says that they have about a year's stockpile of oil. So they're not going to be affected for at least a year by shutting off oil. Furthermore, shutting off oil is what we did to Japan in July 1941, and we ended up in a war with Japan the following December. I don't think China is ever going to shut off oil to North Korea just because Trump wants them to. But even if they did, Vladimir Putin is exactly right when he said the North Koreans will eat grass before they'll give up their nuclear deterrent. I found that statement very interesting, and it suggests Putin knows a hell of a lot more about the North than our president does.
All right, Bruce Cummings, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thanks.
And we'll look forward to having you back. We're going to follow this endlessly, I think. So, all right, Bruce, take care, man.
Bye
now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. Bruce Cummings from the University of Chicago, and we've been talking about what the U.S. is doing in relation to North Korea. And as you heard, it's basically out to get them, full force. Don't ever forget that, and keep your eyes.
Michael Slate from KPFK. Speaking of Pacifica, I just checked Doug Henwood, and what I said earlier, don't believe everything you hear on the radio. Pacifica Foundation Board voted to try to get a loan and not file for bankruptcy, which looked much more indicated. It's distressing beyond belief at this point. Okay, Henwood will be on interviewing in this show Behind the News. Won't have any updates on Pacifica, But if you do Facebook, or I think it's public, you might check there for the discourse. I've been wading through it. Okay, Chris Hedges on Law and Disorder out of a show that's hosted at WBAI in New York City, where the 1.3 million dollar judgment that's causing all this distress, or most of it, is from. All right. I was going to say something about regime change and there is an update, which is that the U.S. did get some kind of limited oil embargo, not complete, cutting back, and there have been accusations of smuggling, and there will be more smuggling, I suppose. And I've been thinking that probably China is probably shipping lots of solar cells to North Korea instead of oil, which, maybe that's a great thing. All right, regime change or coups in our backyard, Honduras, come to mind. I didn't realize this, but listening to Pacifica Flashpoint, the situation in Honduras that the U.S. is going along with is exactly what they were saying, that Zelaya, the previous coup leader, president of Honduras, was trying to do. He was trying to change the constitution that would have allowed for multiple presidential terms, among other things, but not for himself. Whereas the guy that just got elected, quote unquote, through fraud in Honduras, is, among other things, going beyond his term limits. So it's incredibly ironic. I don't know if you've understood what I'm trying to say. I don't know how clear I'm being, but Zelaya was deposed because, among other things, he was supposedly doing something that would have allowed him to run again, which wasn't true, but the guy that is now following the coup government is one who has gone past his term limits. So it makes me think differently about Evo Morales announcing that he's going to run for another term, even though it's not allowed. He can come back and say to the OAS and to the U.S., well, you know, it's okay in Honduras. Why not for Bolivians? Let them vote again. Well, I've only got about 20 minutes for the Chris Hedges interview, which is about half of it. I commend it to your attention. You can find Law and Disorder on Facebook and just Google Law and Disorder Radio and hear the entirety of it. It's pretty engaging. I have some differences with him. I mentioned that he's talking about his liberation theology, which is an interesting argument. It's towards the end of the interview. If you're bent that way, maybe you'd like to listen to it. Well, hunker down, I guess, is the solution. We're going to get polar vortexed here. Postpone those New Year's Day parties, maybe? I don't know. I have to attend to that, I guess. Here is Michael Smith doing the bulk of the interview here. In fact, all of it, I guess, with Chris Hedges today on Law and Disorder. It's a weekly show, comes out on a Monday. And this is Chris Hedges, who, among other things, talks about his show on RT, just in passing, by the way. But there you have it.
And I'd like to talk to you about what you might call a political and moral balance sheet of 2017. Barack Obama left office in January, and now we've got Trump and the forces he reflects and whose interests he advances. You wrote in your book, Unspeakable, that the liberals paved the way for him. You sued Obama in federal courts to block Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which overturned the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act. What was at stake in your lawsuit, and how did it turn out?
Well, let's begin with Obama. So Obama follows in this tradition set by Bill Clinton, whereby all of the traditional causes that the old Democratic Party was at least willing to, I wouldn't always say fight for, but to consider labor, immigrant rights, the rights of African Americans. Clinton abandoned all of these. He continued to use the language of liberalism, that feel your pain language of liberalism, but he betrayed those core constituencies within the Democratic Party. Beginning in 1994 with NAFTA, probably the greatest betrayal of the American working class since the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act, which makes it very difficult for workers to organize. The omnibus crime bill that he pushed through with Biden that massively increased the lengths of sentences, three strikes, you're out laws, you know, long, even life convictions for nonviolent crimes, swelling the prison population from about 700,000 to 2 million. It's now about 2.2 or 2.3. Militarizing police departments, destroying welfare, deregulating the FCC. We're watching the ramifications of that as we speak, the negative ramifications of that, and of course Glass-Steagall. So he catered to corporate interests, and he knew what he was doing. He got corporate money. So by the 90s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity in terms of corporate money with the Republicans, and actually when Obama ran in 2008, he got more. So Obama continued this trajectory of self-identifying as a liberal. Even there's that famous moment when he chastises Cornel West because he says he's a progressive. This is, of course, utterly absurd, especially when you bring in figures like Larry Summers into your cabinet. Geithner, Holder, who's another stooge of Wall Street. And Obama, in some ways, so you had complete continuity in terms of serving the interests of the 1% from Clinton to George W. Bush, to Obama. Obama's assault on civil liberties, as you well know, was worse than those carried out by George W. Bush. And you mentioned my lawsuit when I sued Obama over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act in federal court in the Southern District Court of New York. This overturned the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, as you said, which prohibits the military from carrying out domestic policing. It essentially, at its core, allows the U.S. government to seize U.S. citizens who substantially support, that's a nebulous legal term, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or something called, and I'm quoting, associated forces, whatever that is, strip them of due process and hold them in military facilities, including our offshore black sites, indefinitely, or in the language of Section 1021, until the end of hostilities, which in an age of permanent war is forever. So we went to trial, and the judge, Catherine B. Forrest, ruled that this was in violation of the law, of the 1878 Posse Comitatus, which it clearly is. It was interesting. It got very little press coverage, especially by the so-called liberal or left media like MSNBC, because, of course, all they did was work as a PR firm for the Obama White House. The most journalistically credible coverage actually came from my old employer, the New York Times, which covered the trial. And then when Judge Forrest ruled, wrote an editorial praising her judicial decision. And in her opinion, she wrote that this opens the way for the government to criminalize an entire segment of the population. And she brought up the case of the 110,000 Japanese Americans who were interned in camps in World War II and essentially stripped them of all rights. I mean, carry out acts of extraordinary rendition on the streets of American cities and disappear them because they don't have access to a lawyer once they're seized. So this was Obama. Obama, I think most legal scholars would say, grossly misinterpreted the 2002 Authorization to Use Military Force Act as giving the U.S. government the right to assassinate American citizens, as we saw with Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen and, of course, his 16-year-old son. It was Obama who misused the Espionage Act, which is the equivalent of our kind of Foreign Secrets Act, to shut down whistleblowers. And as James Risen and other from the New York Times will tell you, it essentially killed the possibility of any kind of serious investigative journalism into the machinery of government itself, which was its intent. So what we saw was the betrayal of that constituency with deeply hypocritical language about continuing to care about that constituency. Obama, I think, was in many ways our last chance to deal seriously with climate change, with social inequality, which is now going to be turbocharged with this tax bill. So we saw a revolt. We saw a revolt in the Democratic Party with Bernie Sanders, the Democratic machine, of course, ensuring that he did not get the nomination, and a revolt with Trump. But I argue, you know, I have a show on RT, so I'm kind of caught up in this demonization of Russia, this witch hunt, which, of course, the elites don't want to address the fundamental issue, that it was their betrayal of the working class in particular that gave rise to these insurgencies and led to the election of this very frightening, buffoonish, but very frightening and dangerous figure who now occupies the presidency and is rapidly dismantling our very anemic, already very anemic system by which we can protect ourselves from the worst exploitation and predatory abuses of the corporate state.
You didn't support Bernie Sanders, but you do believe that he did a few good things. Like what?
I the night before the climate march in New York, where I spoke with Bernie and Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein and Shama Sawant, Shama and I raised the issue of Bernie running as an independent, and we were both very clear that we would support him if he ran as an independent, although I have to throw in this caveat. Bernie Sanders just will not take on the military-industrial complex or empire. At its most kind of basic level, you can't be a socialist unless you are an anti-imperialist. However, he has throughout his life with consistency addressed issues of social inequality and the programs that have made war on the working and increasingly the middle class. But his decision to run as a Democrat, in my view, and I think the facts bore that out, was a huge mistake. I never believed the Democratic Party would allow him to gain the nomination, which is what happened, and there were all sorts of dirty tricks they used, not just all the dark money, $1 billion I think Clinton raised, but banning independents from voting in the primaries, although I should say taxpayers pay for the logistical carrying out of the primaries, stealing the Nevada caucus, superdelegates. I mean, they game the system, not to mention, of course, we now know that the DNC, not surprisingly, was part of the Clinton machine. So, and my fear at the time and Shama's fear was that there would be all this enthusiasm, all this energy, and all this money, and he raised significant money, and small contributions mostly, would in the end be squandered with him running around telling us to vote for Hillary Clinton. That we had to build a movement, a third-party movement, a resistance movement that extended beyond an electoral cycle. And Bernie's answer was, I don't want to end up like Ralph Nader, and I admire Ralph, I was a speechwriter. And he was right. The Democratic Party would have destroyed him. That assessment was correct. They have a quid pro quo with him where they don't run a serious candidate against him in his Senate races in Vermont, and he works to stymie third-party movements in Vermont. So he's right. But for me, that was an act of political cowardice. He would have lost his seniority. And now we're watching him try and mount a campaign to run again. But my position remains the same.
You know, you supported Jill Stein. As I did, she was a guest on our show, and she offered Bernie Sanders her spot on the Green Party ticket. And my thought was, had he taken it, I think he missed his historic opportunity, but had he taken it and had he organized a viable movement, even if he would have lost the presidency, there would have been a movement there to put a brake on what these Trump and billionaires behind him are doing. And we don't have that instrument now.
That's exactly right. And, you know, this was always Ralph's argument. Nobody understands corporate power or has been fighting it longer or with more integrity than Ralph Nader. And Ralph said, you know, this was back in 2000, we have to get 5, 10, 15 million people who are willing to step outside the Democratic Party establishment so that we can pressure the Democratic Party to counter this assault, this kind of assault that they're carrying out on behalf of the 1%, the corporate oligarchs. You're right, he wouldn't have won, but it would have created that pressure. That's number one. Number two, it takes a long time to build an alternative political movement. Parties like Syriza a decade ago in Greece were polling at about 4%, which is slightly higher than what the Green Party gets. But it's not going to happen within an election cycle. And we desperately, I don't know, we can speak about this later. I mean, the situation now has deteriorated to such an extent. I don't know how much resistance politically within the political system we're going to be able to mount. But yeah, for all of those reasons, not that he cared or anyone cared, I didn't endorse him. I did, you know, in the primaries, certainly vote for him in New Jersey.
Do you believe that an insurgency can take back the Democratic Party? You know, what's the alternative?
No, because the leadership of the Democratic Party is a creation of the oligarchic elite, figures like Schumer, Pelosi, the Clintons. I mean, we would have to begin with campaign finance, i.e., these large corporate entities cannot fund our system of legalized bribery. These people would disappear as political figures. The Democratic Party doesn't function as a political party like the Labor Party, which had mechanisms within it to, of course, the shock of the traditional Labor Party leadership that allowed the rise of Corbyn. There is no party. It's kind of the base doesn't matter. The base is mobilized. There's a kind of hyperventilating media. But if you talk about a political party as actually expressing the will and the desires of the base, the Democratic Party is not a party in the way, you know, parliamentary parties are in Britain or in other parts of Europe.
Chris, do you think we have any institutions left yet that can authentically be called democratic if we define democracy to mean the expression of popular will?
No, not any. And that is the assessment of our most important political philosopher, Sheldon Wolin, who died recently. I recommend his book, Democracy Incorporated, to everyone. Like all great thinkers, Wolin helped give me the vocabulary to understand the reality around us, in particular the political reality. He describes our system as one of what he calls inverted totalitarianism. And by that he means it's not a classical totalitarian system whereby you have a charismatic or led by a charismatic or demagogic figure, but you have you've undergone what John Ralston Saul calls this corporate coup d'etat, where you have the facade, like the old Roman Republic, of the Constitution, electoral politics, the iconography and language of American patriotism. But internally, corporations have seized all of the levers of power to render the citizen impotent. And I think that's right. I think that's where we are. And that's why I've been a strong supporter of movements. Standing Rock, I went to Standing Rock. I was, of course, very supportive of the Occupy movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement against Israel. I think we've got to pit power against power now. And the only power we have is to build alternative institutions and powerful movements that carry out sustained acts of civil disobedience.
We forgot to mention Occupy, and this is not a well-known fact, I think. Occupy was shut down by a coordinated attack by the Obama administration.
Yeah, completely.
That was one of the reasons you list in your book, Unspeakable, for why you dislike liberals so deeply.
Yeah, I learned to dislike liberals when I went to Harvard Divinity School, but I lived in the housing projects in Roxbury and commuted every day into Cambridge, where my classmates would sit around talking about empowering people they never met. That kind of cured me on a liberal class.
I went to NYU Law School, where my classmates would sit there and get their shoes shined reading the Wall Street Journal out in the front stoops.
Right.
A chapter in Unspeakable is titled Revolution or Fascism. What do we have to do politically, given that alternative?
Well, I mean, Trump is the logical conclusion to a decayed democracy, in the same way that Slobodan Milosevic — I covered Yugoslavia for the New York Times — Slobodan Milosevic or Radovan Karadzic were the logical conclusion to the collapse of a kind of attempt within the 1990s to create, or 1980s, excuse me, to create a kind of functioning democracy within Yugoslavia, as was the rise of the Nazis' response to the collapse of the Weimar Republic, but particularly after the 1929 crash, when the socialist government under Ebert attempted to impose austerity, which was the response of the Democratic Party, imposing programs of austerity, which of course makes things worse. And so the rise of a figure like Trump essentially signals, as it does at the end of any dying empire, the seizure of power by the kleptocrats. Now, Trump, of course, personally is a kleptocrat, and we see it with the tax bill. I think he and his heirs stand to gain $1 billion a year just on this bill or something. But more importantly, the kleptocracies carried out by the big banks, by the fossil fuel industry that just seized 2 million acres of land in Utah. There's no restraint. There are no internal or external restraints. And these people know only one word, and that's more. So appealing to the system to carry out acts of reform, which is what they want us to do. They want us to write petitions or call our congressmen or congresswoman's office.
Donate a dollar.
Send a dollar or, you know, to moveon.org. There's an organization nobody should give money to. Build grassroots campaigns and be part of the Bernie revolution, whatever he's going to call it now. And this is just, you know, if we haven't learned by now, an utter and complete waste of energy and time. But if you step outside the system, I think we saw it with Standing Rock. So there you had nonviolent water protectors led by our indigenous leaders. And the response of the state, this is under Obama, was fierce. Rubber bullets, over 700 people arrested. Water cannons laced with pepper spray in sub-freezing temperatures. Attack dogs, constant surveillance, drones. When I went there in November, you had private contractors. They didn't even have any distinguishing. They weren't law enforcement. They had kind of quasi-military uniforms, but you didn't know who they were, carrying long-barreled weapons, blocking these back roads. I mean, I had to go all the way around up north, and it took us hours to get in, stopping our vehicles and sending us back. And, of course, it is going to be even worse under Trump for any kind of resistance. Because essentially we're at a moment in American history where the ruling ideology, neoliberalism, globalization, unfettered capitalism, whatever you want to call it, is bankrupt. Nobody's buying it, on the left or the right. Nobody's buying this ideology. And there is no counterargument. They have no counterargument now to those of us who are critics. And so where before we had been marginalized, shut out of the mainstream media, now we have to be shut down, and that's the process we're watching. So you see the imposition by Google, Facebook, you know, these big corporations that are wedded to the national security state, the imposition of algorithms they call it impressions, but to move people away from dissident, progressive, anti-war, left-wing websites, including not only the ones I write for, but the ones that reprint my stuff. So Alternet's traffic is down by 63%. World Socialist website is down by 80%. Truthdig, where I write a column every Monday, is down by 20%. That, coupled with the destruction of net neutrality, essentially gives the state the ability to impose a very frightening form of censorship. And that's what's coming next. Because suddenly, those of us, those who are anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist critics, become dangerous, and is because the ideology that has justified this pillage no longer has any credibility. You know who writes about this is Alexander Berkman in an essay, I can't remember the name of it, but he writes this essay that says that when the ruling elite's credibility is destroyed, whether it's the monarchy or anything else, then all they have left is the iron fist. That's it. And ideology, as Gramsci understood, propaganda, ideology, are powerful tools of control. But they don't have those tools. That's another issue. But the whole demonization of Russia, the ability to attack people such as myself, and this, of course, these algorithms are imposed by Google because of supposedly fake news. And this is what, you know, despotisms always do. They attempt to paint us as in service of a foreign power, traitors. And this is, of course, what they're doing to Jill Stein, the Green Party, right now.
They're trying to hook her up with the whole Russian BS story.
Michael Smith of Law and Disorder Radio. You can find it on the web. There's another 20 minutes. Maybe I'll play it tomorrow. Berkman was a partner and anarchist, right? That's who I think he's talking with. I meant to look that up. I'm pretty sure that's right. Chris Hedges speaking there with Michael Smith of... As I said, Law and Disorder Radio, hosted out of WBAI in New York. It's nominally about his book Unspeakable. I guess he said some stuff that's outside. It's a forbidden topic. Written with David Talbot. Boy, I'm having some trouble today. I hope you're doing all right. Be safe. It's going to get dangerous outside if it already is. Do you think it's cold this year? Wait until next, I've been saying. Doug Henwood, his Facebook page is where I'm learning the depressing news about Pacifica trying to borrow their way out of this judgment when there's not time to do.